Saint Isaac of Nineveh is a representative of the Syriac tradition who is at the very end of the period that we would consider in our study of patristics. We've jumped ahead quite a ways to the latter half of the 7th century. He lives somewhere between 630 and about 700. He is very briefly the bishop of Nineveh, at a time when his own theology and the theology of his people was divergent from that of the Council of Chalcedon. He's regarded as a Nestorian. And nevertheless, his writings, especially his ascetical writings, become very popular, are translated rather quickly into several languages, including Greek and Armenian. And his writings are also available in Ethiopic and Arabic. So he is influential in the Eastern Church especially, and his writings are read even though he is under the cloud of having been regarded as a Nestorian, as having not been regarded as in proper communion with the tradition of the ecumenical councils. This remains an issue, of course, for the churches of the East today. Many of them are still not reconciled to, especially the Council of Chalcedon, and are sometimes labeled as Nestorians, which title they often vigorously reject. But that's, again, a different separate subject in the whole area of ecumenical theology. Saint Isaac of Nineveh is of great interest to people today because of his writings both in the area of prayer and his understanding of contemplation, but also because of his vision of a love of God that seems to involve a bringing together of a tradition that respects both the finality of our choices on earth and a sense of God's eternal compassion that reaches into the next life. And even for those who are not reconciled at the time of their death. This is a continuing aspect of the problem of the apokatastasis, which we particularly saw with Origen, the question of the salvation of all on the last day. Isaac of Nineveh offers an answer or a hint that is both open to the apokatastasis on the one hand, or maybe, and also does justice to a tradition of the possibility of suffering in the next life as well, as we shall see. And his writings were so regarded as so significant and as so valuable that one of the reflections we'll be looking at almost made it into the Catechism of the Catholic Church. It was included in the rough draft which was sent around to all the dioceses of the world, but unfortunately the selection from Isaac of Nineveh in the section of the Catechism on Hell was not retained. And as we'll see, it's his insight, his notion, that on the last day, in eternity, there is only one thing, the love of God, and heaven or hell are two different ways of experiencing that one reality. But let's look first at this homily 28, which contains that insight, but which also begins with a reflection on the nature of vision and the nature of what had been since Evagrius regarded as a distinction between different kinds of contemplative experience, the beholding of that which is incorporeal, or one might even say a kind of participation in the sort of vision which the incorporeals, that is to say the angels, share. There's a kind of a fascination with what is the kind of contemplation that is enjoyed by the spirits that work for our salvation, and what are the limitations and the warped version of that that is experienced by the demons. Obviously more speculation than one can engage in comfortably using revelation, but a meditation that one does find, a kind of question that one does find in quite a few authors in the area of mystical theology. So he begins in homily 28, and we will work rather quickly through this first section, and I invite you to go back and look at it on your own. He describes a direct apprehension of simple and spiritual nature, which is possible for human nature, and he gives it in three ways. He makes a distinction between three different kinds of contemplation, and I'll leave it to you to look at those in more detail, and then he uses that as a way of distinguishing between the kind of vision that is possible for human beings and angels and demons. And he asks the question, Why is it that angels have one kind of vision and demons do not have another, or have another and are deprived of a certain kind? And effectively, he's opening the question of what is the kind of experience, what is the sort of relationship to the divine or to the world that God has created that is experienced by those who are saved in communion with God and those who have chosen rejection, have chosen separation from God, symbolized, experienced most powerfully by the demons. So he's raising this question of the nature of the age to come. And if you drop down to the blue bar labeled the age to come, the scourge of love, this is the section where he raises the issues that, as I mentioned, were considered at one point for inclusion in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. In the future age, he says, this order of things will be abolished. This distinction between different kinds of contemplation will not exist in the world to come. And then in the highlighted text in the lower part of that first paragraph, for they, the blessed, do not perceive him through diverse intellections or contemplations, but by direct revelation of him without departing from him through thoughts. And on one alone hangs the ardent love of all. And this is really Isaac of Nineveh's conviction, that in the age to come there will only be the love of God. Ultimately, it's not a question of the damned not knowing about love, but experiencing love as something painful. And one can find analogies for this in one's own experience. I think everybody has experiences of being loved by people whom one simply doesn't want to be around, experiencing the love of individuals as something oppressive or something that one has to run away from. What if that were experienced in the only true love that exists in all the universe? Then one's experience truly would be hell, because that is the only thing in the world to come. Part of my ascetical task, the ascetical task of every Christian, is therefore to be able to grow into a desire for and a longing for that love which is the foundation of the universe and will be the one thing on the last day. So Isaac can say in the section that follows, those who are punished in Gehenna are scourged by the scourge of love. The only scourge, the only pain, is the pain of being loved. What is more bitter and vehement than the torment of love? Those who are conscious that they have sinned against love suffer greater torment than from any fear of punishment. The awareness of, and he calls it a sin against love, but the one might phrase it differently, the ongoing choice to live apart from, to not desire, to want to turn away from, that love which is the basis of all existence. It would be improper, he says, for a man to think that sinners in Gehenna are deprived of the love of God. Love is given to all. One might say the embrace of love is eternal life, and that embrace will either be experienced as joy and bliss or as pain and suffering. And he says the power of love torments sinners, even as it sometimes happens that a friend can suffer from a friend. But it's a source of joy for those who have observed its duties. This is the torment of Gehenna, bitter regret, but regret in the face of and in the experience of love. Love inebriates the souls of the sons of heaven by its delectability. So this is a vision of the next world that is very popular in the churches of the East, and one even finds it in the writings of some Greek theologians. It leads to a kind of an ongoing hope for apokatastasis, that this experience of love as pain in the next world is transforming, has the power to be something that simply doesn't leave one statically in pain, but carries with it the possibility of a new choice to enter into and allow oneself to be embraced by and even to share and ultimately rejoice in that love. So if we then move to the second half of this page, the portion mysteriously labeled the second part, and one might well ask the second part of what, but this is the title of this text. It's just called the second part. It's a manuscript of material by Isaac of Nineveh that was discovered in the Bodleian Library by Sebastian Brock, one of the most important Syriac scholars in the world today. He's been publishing Syriac authors and making available the rich treasuries of the churches of the East in English to people who are interested in it. And in this text, we see a very practical, ascetical series of recommendations for people who are involved in the business of prayer, for people who pray liturgically, presumably primarily for monastics, for people in monastic communities, but one could also generalize and to say all of those who are primarily obliged to or have as a part of their spiritual lives the praying of what we would call the Liturgy of the Hours, what he calls the canonical prayers. And so one finds, if we drop down to number 3, that varieties of different prayers help greatly a mind that is harassed by distractions, and there is a kind of a strength that results from them in which the soul can acquire compunction, a sense of being inwardly pierced. This will be very important in the hesychastic tradition, as we've seen, and so acquires sweet prayer, prolonged kneeling or prostration, intercession for creation, and extended supplications. This happens because with every single word that he encounters in these prayers, and he's not talking about a methodology, or is not talking about something one can always do, but the gift of a kind of prayer that allows a single word or a single experience to, as it were, as in Cassian's language, become incandescent, to blossom forth in a kind of new life. And so one awakens from sleep and encounters astonishing insights. This is a kind of intermittent contemplative joy that happens during the experience of prayer. And he says, during periods of grace, when you enjoy this prayer of delight and those prolonged prostrations, there's no necessity for you to stand by the canonical hours or worry yourself over the matter of the numbers of prayers that remain to be excited. This is, again, number 4, for such prayer has encompassed within itself the recited prayers according to the fixed numbers. He's inviting people to have flexibility in their own life of prayer in regard to the precisely fixed form of the canonical hours, the Liturgy of the Hours. He's saying, if you have this wonderful experience of being called by God into this prayer that involves you to prostrate, to be aware of God, to see through into the deeper realities of things, to offer prayers of intercession, don't feel that now you have to go back and pray all the rest of the leftover psalms. That has, he's implying, taken the place of certain aspects of the office. And he says, at the time of some great work, do not turn to one that is lesser. He's not saying you should simply do or try to acquire or be in this state, but when it does happen, don't feel that that in a sense doesn't count as your canonical prayer. And this is a very interesting tradition. He in number 7 in particular, talks about laws and rules that can keep one from the illumination that comes from God. And he says in number 8, as long as someone has the times of day divided up in part for the office, in part for reading the scriptures, in part for prayer, and in part for other works, once the time for paying dues has arrived, he is obliged of necessity to pay the dues to the time allotted. It's not possible for him to pass it over. It's necessary to fulfill the obligation of each of the canonical rules in its proper place and its proper time. But as we'll see, if someone, he says in number 9, is clinging to God unceasingly in a continual outpouring that takes place in prayer, his soul swallowed up with yearning as he falls before the cross, this person is not subject to any law or canonical rules. So there is a kind of prayer, an experience in prayer that, as it were, dispenses one from this canonical obligation. It's perhaps a little alarming to us, and we'd like him to be a little more precise. In the Eastern Church, there is a tradition or understanding that sometimes repetitions of the Jesus Prayer can take the place of certain hours of the Divine Office. But let's not get distracted into that point now. Dropping down to chapter 5 from the same work, he gives examples of prayers. He here describes prayers that can be offered at the time of prayer by people who are engaged in either canonical prayer or this being swept up into an experience of God. And here we have, in these 4 prayers that I have given, a kind of an insight into the heart of Isaac of Nineveh, a sense of what his own experience of prayer was like.